And I'm not a really good American because I like to form my own opinions.
Huh? What?
There's tons of examples of corporate greed, inequality, and disregard for the environment that make people wonder if markets are evil. And they are.
Maybe Mises is right about America being a land of opportunity. And maybe it deals has a point about the machinery of capitalism being oiled with the blood of the workers.
Where it's like, hey, wake up, liberals. You can't always do, sometimes you gotta, but that's actual quote from Karl Marx.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it.
If I were to ever start a country with a communist government, wink, wink, wait 12 years.
Men are seduced by communists, women so much so that they deem communism nice. Communists murdered mostly the Nazis.
Bottom-up horizontal connection, sharing at all levels is key.
Describing as anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
You mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
What kind of garbage is that? Oops, my anarchy symbol.
Okay, for the second hour of the Three Left Show, welcome back. If you are listening to the first hour, if you are just listening now, I'm your host, Dan Platt. This is the Three Left Show, your place for leftist news and analysis. And I'm about to read from the other side of the break. Basically, we're discussing, I was doing a reading from a report on the Russian Revolution.
Whoa, where's my second introduction? I'm Josh.
Okay, yes, second introduction. Yes, and I'm joined by Josh. Say hi, Josh.
Hi.
And anything else you want to say?
That's it.
So, I'm in a rush here. So I'm going to read the structure of the labor organizations in Russia. So, like, what were the unions like in the Russian Revolution? Was it all just violence? What were the people actually doing? Or is it, you know, there's this kind of trope in American dialogue that when you overthrow the government, you're just replacing one tyranny with another, so there's, like, no point, you know? Power corrupts, right? So if you take power, then you're just going to become the next boss, which is so disempowering. It's so nihilistic. I think there are a lot of, there's certainly a good amount of people who believe there's no point in even trying to do social change because it's, like, there's also the lie that, like, what we have is natural. Ugh.
Oh, my God.
So, so this piece here is, oh, yeah, this is a good part here. So, because this also gets into, there's different classes of workers, right? Professional workers. There's even different unions, and this is bared out. Here in New York, we have, there's two public employee unions. There's the one that's the blue-collar workers, and there's the one for the white-collar workers, because, God forbid, they should be in the same union. And I'm literally quoting what this person from the 20s was writing here. It is necessary to clearly show the particular characteristics of the Russian unions in order to understand their role and importance. There was no revolution without the unions, as it were. In Russia, the unions were not built on a narrow trade basis. A metal worker, for example, in a weaving factory, is a member of the textile union, while the carpenter, if he worked in a metal factory, is a member of the metal workers union. That means that not only the manual workers, but the clerks, the technicians, too, working in a metallurgical enterprise, belong to the metal workers union. This form of representation or organization is very difficult to establish. The personnel of the offices and the techs, especially the latter, did not want at any price to be incorporated in the same union with workers. Some of them declared that it was not becoming that graduated engineers should mix with and disappear in the large gray mass, right? To even be part of society is to lose one's individuality. Another lie. But the unions resolutely, with their insistence, declared themselves against all kinds of craft unions. Right, we have, or trade unions, as they're called in America. The engineers and the whole personnel were obliged to enter the proletarian ranks. And by the way, this is important because the trade unions, the ones that pretty much the unions that are left, are not they do not have much solidarity about them. Like, they do not, like, it's emblematic when, say, the pipe fitters union or the construction union, like, they will be for any kind of big construction project, no matter what it is. All right. It could be a casino. It could be oil pipelines. It could be prisons. Right. They're for it because that's a guaranteed job for them. But they're putting themselves over any solidarity with other workers, the workers that will be imprisoned in the prisons, obviously, the communities that will be harmed and polluted and poisoned, as well as our entire world by oil pipelines and so on and so on. So anyway, the engineers, and they're back to the Russian here, the engineers and their whole personnel were obliged to enter the proletarian ranks. I think there might have been some threatening at all. Now in the Metal Workers Union, there exists a section of engineers and mechanics, the same in the Textile Union, in the Union of Chemical Products, and so on. The most obstinate resistance was offered by physicians. They protested in the most categorical manner against the idea of one only union where the physicians and the attendants and the drugstores would be members. So the pharmacists. To be in the same union with a nurse, what horror. A laundress working in the hospital constantly seemed to them an outrage against science and the university. But the fire of the revolution melted much greater prejudices. The prejudice of the physicians were melted as well. Today they form together with the hospital and the ambulance service personnel, the EMTs, one union, that of the public health workers. This we can draw directly to today that nurses are organizing. But why is it only the nurses? Because the doctors don't have any solidarity with the nurses. Now, no, that's not actually true. There are doctors, there are organizations of doctors that are organizing for single-payer health care and health care reform. So they have solidarity with the rest of society for that. But some will come out for the nurses, but it's a minority, I can tell you. We got to jump.
Yeah, it seems like a reoccurring problem that the healthcare industry or the health industry has quite a division in its labor. I don't know how you would. I mean, I feel like it goes to the ego of a physician that. I went to school for 10 years and this nurse went to community college for 2 years.
Case anymore. I mean, a nurse's training is
right.
5-6 years now.
I mean, like, see, like, that's an issue. Like, how do you address that? I mean, I think if you read more, it goes into the fact, I think the state basically, I don't know. We'll read more, but it just like,
well, is it okay if I stop there? Cooperative union, because then I can segue into, like, before the break, you mentioned that, you know, a change in government requires organized labor.
Absolutely.
The New Deal coalition was held together by union power. The fact that there was high unionization in the 30s and 40s is what allowed the Democrats, ruling party that they are that represents capital interests, they were basically pressured and forced to do the New Deal reforms, right? Now, maybe as far as speeches and the recordings and what's shown on the History Channel, it looks like these politicians were acting of their own volition for the good of the country. But, well, it was also for the fact that they had a career in the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party was, you know, had the unions behind them, and their elections, their office was dependent on labor support. But that's why there was such a fervor in the 50s to then. They couldn't attack the unions directly, so instead they attacked socialism and communism, and so stripped the unions of any militancy and thus their ability to actually fight back against the attack of capital. And so they were slowly dismantled decade by decade. And it would take many, you know, false starts. But, you know, by the 80s, then they were fully under attack. And by the aughts, completely destroyed.
Exactly. And I have to say, I think time has worked in state's favor in regards to the de-unionization of the workforce. Because yeah. I think, and this is something I hear from people who are literally on the fence about, like when I talk to people at my own workplace, a person's on the fence because they would say, oh, I understand unionization of trade, like of certain trades, like metalwork and so forth. But for retail, like this one person I know, Joe Mart.
Well, like they're not exploited?
Well, no, but see, he doesn't look at it like that. He sees that there's more room for growth. I don't know. There's like there's a different way of looking at it that I have yet to grasp.
Oh, right. Room for advance. Like there's a ladder to climb.
Exactly. And it's not. And it's
in
not.
Construction,
it's not...
what's the ladder to climb? The ladder is actually like professional versus like in order to climb that ladder, you have to go to school for 6 years.
Right.
To be a project manager or an architect. And, you know, never does unionization ever enter the minds of any architecture school or whatever. Like, I would think about it because I would read about how, as interns, totally exploited, there was a surge of, and it continues, unpaid internships, where you're doing work and you're literally not being paid for it. You are a slave, you know, but you're an intern, which is, you know,
that's
unimaginable. And I didn't participate at all. I didn't take any internship that wouldn't have paid me. And for that reason, I am behind, and thus I don't really have an architecture career because I chose not to participate in that exploitive track. But it wasn't really offered to me because at the time, you know, there wasn't even any internships to be had, paid or unpaid. But that was kind of they said, like, well, we can't pay you because of the recession. And all our students had to, if you were going to participate because of family pressure that, you know, I didn't have, or what have you, or they're just the pressure to that make your degree pay, you know, and actually increase your income, you're just going to have to roll over and take it. And I didn't want to do that.
Stuck to your guns. Courage of your conviction.
Well,
it's rare.
I was raised to stand for something so I don't fall for anything.
Yeah, well, I think your mom should go mother a bunch of other people out there.
Well,
I don't know, but
that.
So, but back to the unions. But I think part of it is also how labor intensive a job is that makes someone see, maybe they deserve what they're getting because their labor isn't as intense. You know, like I think that's the biggest thing when you look at people who are saying like, oh, I understood it back in the 50s when, you know, you had steel workers and brickwork makers and things like that. And that's what I meant by I think time is on the side of the state deunionizing, because as time went on, those jobs left. So it gave credence to the idea that, oh, retail workers and everyone else, they don't need a union because that's easy work. You know, like that's, I don't know. It's
not worth the wages that would be demanded. Right.
Right.
These are the minimum wage entry level positions of the economy.
Right.
But there is no entry level anymore. Or rather, entry level. Because I mean, we joke about it all the time as millennials that there would be listed entry level positions, 2 years experience required.
Exactly.
Where is that supposed to come from? You know, if we went to high school and focused on passing all our tests and then go to college and then focus on getting a degree, you know, it's assumed that we'll be picking up these jobs along the way and getting basic retail work experience, right? But if we're supposed to be doing everything we're supposed to, it's in the middle class fashion, like I did, then no, I didn't have all this work experience when I graduated college. And it was very frustrating for me. And now as age 30, I'm pretty much aware quote-unquote society, capitalist society, expected me to be when I was at age 20, as far as like what my resume looks like or whatever. But I don't judge myself based on that, but obviously the market does. that's why I'm kind of anti-market, because it has a different standard of judging me than I would judge myself. Different values, well, oppositional, you know? So we have a few more minutes before our first break of the hour. So I guess I'll start by starting our little transition here. The rest of the hour, we'll be talking about elections, electoral politics. Kind of actually quoting some of my intro there. Not intro, the montage intro of Loose and Liberal. So, so in order to build like third-party power or an alternative or to win elections in any way, just as the socialists did in the 20s and 30s, when there was a real third party, which was the socialists, which is kind of wiped from collective memory for good reason as far as the capitalists are concerned, because they were winning 20, 25, 30% of the vote in presidential races, and they were winning governorships and mayorships all over the country. How were they able to do this? How were they, you know, you got to fund campaigns, right? We don't have public financing, and we likely never will. So,
stop.
Yeah. Let's be optimistic. You know, one day, once all the Bernie-crats are elected, they will most certainly push through clean elections bills. Some, you know, it annoys me. They don't even mention it very much. I know why, because like you got to offer the goods, you know, to get people's votes. Totally agree. And that means talking about raising wages and fighting inequality and more economic and more empowerment, right? That's what gets people's attention. And so you kind of like it's kind of baked in, but assume that they will also pass public financing of elections. But it's not ever mentioned because unless you're a wonk or, you know, some political nerd already, you don't care. But
I'm curious if Bernie Sanders was to run in 2020. I remember that was a staple of his 2016 election of like campaign finance reform and things like that.
But it wouldn't
that.
Say how. I suppose I needed to read what this platform said, but I kind of assume that if he's going to talk about it in vague terms, then the website will too.
I'm pretty sure it did. I think there was a policy laid out.
Was it block grants?
I'm not sure.
If it's not block grants, I don't care. A block grant meaning like if you qualify as a candidate, like get your petitions in, you get 10% of what was spent in the last election.
Could you imagine the participation?
It would be like
so many people I know who are. Yeah, so many people are like, oh, I don't have the time or the money. I'd be like, well, here you go.
Right. I mean, well, that goes for any kind of enterprise. But, like, politics needs to be thought of like that. But instead, it's not. And we'll get to that later after the other side of the break. Thank you. This has been the Three Left Show. So due to a technical glitch, there was some audio that was lost or particularly not recorded. So I'm going to by myself read the opening of this article, and then it'll jump in as Josh asks me about Huey Long, based on being reminded of him because liberals like mentioning FDR. So what I was reading was from the Black Agenda Report, an open letter to socialists who might be fronting for the Democratic Party. So this is in the context of talking about electoralism. This was a week before Election Day in 2018. So this is from a Mexican-American in L.A. Starting now. Any socialist who thought, as I did, that Ocasio-Cortez would be our socialist champion should watch the entire 27-minute PBS firing line interview to get a sense of just how bad this train wreck might be. First, a confession. When I learned of Cortez's primary victory against incumbent dinosaur Joe Crowley, I was, as embarrassing as it was to admit, moved to tears. I'm an emotional type. Take after my mom. I'm also a Xanax, a lifelong socialist, and was overwhelmed to see a young brown woman step up and raise the socialist banner. Now, however, as weeks have passed since her primary victory, as she has made the rounds of the talk show circuit, has been vetted by progressive circles and interviewed by corporate and, quote,
quote, left media, and of course also shilled for Democratic Party candidates. She has said enough to make me wonder if she's making this whole socialism thing up as she goes along. A further concession, I did donate to her campaign. So I received emails that I'll be sharing. The same message that she also shared at the Democratic Party Love Fest, Netroots Nation. Mostly about, as the article goes on, that she talks about the real Democratic Party of FDR and the Great Society, that's what she wants to bring back. And that young people and everyone else following a socialist message should come home to the Democratic Party. She must be receiving this from the Democratic Party's fairy tale and children's section of the Democratic Party. You know, a blue version of Make America Great Again. And so then with this article, he goes into all of the different ways the Democrats have, you know, various war crimes that they, in part, destroyed the left as soon as they saved capitalism with the New Deal by taking on, you know, some of the planks, but not entirely, you know. And he goes through all the problems with the Johnson administration, how the Voting Rights Act has been gutted, and basically the whole cavalcade of things where how the war on poverty has been a war on black people, war on drugs, and basically how the Democrats, over the time, as well as from the 80s, have been partners in the neoliberal agenda that oppresses us, and not an opposition. But somehow self-avowed socialists would have us believe that the actual Democratic Party, the war and pillage party of Indian killer Andrew Jackson and so on, and President Wilson, and the party of the KKK, you know, that's not the real Democratic Party. And it's truly Orwellian. The real Democratic Party is supposed to be something akin to a grade school civics project, and its real history might be found in a textbook on U.S. mythology titled something asinine like The Great Democratic Pageant. Maybe you had that textbook in your high school. He also takes on in this article, which I need to cover quickly, though, writers from Jacobin who talk of a socialist party or something like a party like the DSA, but then the DSA will never actually always just be endorsing Democrats. That these organizations, like, are they using the Democrats to further socialism, or are they being used by the establishment to basically, you know, make socialism just a tool of theirs? For example, you know, Ocasio-Cortez was Ocasio-Cortez was anointed by the DSA and is now the de facto national spokesperson on socialism in the U.S. But is she using the Democratic Party to further a socialist people's agenda? Or is she using the DSA and the people's natural inclination towards socialism to further the ultimately capitalist agenda of the Democratic Party? When push comes to shove, to whom will she and other DSA Democratic candidates be loyal? Heck, to whom will DSA be loyal? In the long term, will focusing on running socialist candidates within the Democratic Party impede building an independent socialist movement or any organization?
I mean, it sounds just about right. You know, anytime I hear a liberal drop FDR, I love bringing up Huey Long. You know about Huey Long?
Co-founder of the Black Panther Party?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, sorry. Yeah, no. Huey Long, the governor. He was a populist. He was yes. Kind of right-wing.
He wasn't, though. I don't think he was right-wing at all, because a lot of...
Oh, that's right. No, yeah. He was kind of left of center, yeah.
He was a Democrat, and literally, I love bringing this up. Literally, I know, like, decades of socialist work and the contributions have contributed to policies which are reflective in the New Deal. But a lot of the direct policies that were passed, like Social Security, were taken from the policies that Huey Long had created for Louisiana. He wanted to set up a pension program for the elderly. And like literally most of the New Deal policies came from Huey Long, who was going to primary FDR in 1933, but was mysteriously assassinated by a doctor. So I just love bringing that up. I know I'm not trying to be conspiratorial, but the fact that
But political assassinations do happen.
Of course. No, I just love that.
They do happen today, too. And there's this kind of blindness that, like, after the fall of the Soviet Union or, like, the end of history, that political assassinations would then stop. Because, you know, we have a civil democratic society where we don't have to have political assassinations anymore. Quite delusional. Sorry. Not delusional. It's like, it's naive. It's just ill-informed.
If the state is threatened enough,
yeah,
they'll take measures. But yeah, so
it's
I always assume that
nothing could threaten the state because, you know, it's such a, everyone loves how civil our society is. But now that's falling apart, you know, and we're not in the state of normal anymore. So maybe some of those people will realize that political assassinations can actually happen and not call anyone who points them out with disdain. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I just think that because he was gaining, and if you look into him, I think he's one of the most underrated politicians in American history. If you look into him, he literally was gaining so much momentum. He like did so much for the poor and the workers of Louisiana.
Right. He was going to primary FDR, but you also had Debs who would actively run against him too. And he got like 15-20% vote.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's an amazing politician. Everyone should look into him. Huey Long, yeah. The dictator of Louisiana.
Sure,
the second
right.
thing.
He gets a bad rap from mainstream quarters, I guess.
Exactly. And if it's, if it's an indication, dropping that term dictator means something.
He's kind of painted as a political boss. Sort.
Yeah, exactly. Don't like this guy because he's a... But Cortez, you know... The way I think about it, I think we all are, whoever's listening to this podcast, are so distrustful of the Democratic Party. Not to assume, like, to me, like, when I saw that there was a socialist running in the Democratic Party, I knew something was up. They wouldn't let a full-fledged socialist run on their line if they didn't concede to any, like, to something specific. Like, I don't know. I think
they have ways of just striking someone off the ballot, you know? They know that she serves a purpose.
Exactly.
Says, come home to the Dem Party, that's sheepdogging right there. Sheepdogging.
How much influence on her rhetoric does the Democratic Party have directly? Like, how much is coming from her heart,
Too much. I mean, I think, like, there was literally a sea change where, like, the second she wins the primary and cries, she goes to meet in Washington with the congressional leaders. And then bam, suddenly, like, she walks back a bunch of positions, and then she's basically, you know, a young Bernie. As far as, not like Bernie, because Bernie doesn't join the Democratic Party, at least in name. Then the sheepdogging commences. Now, I want to get in the last few minutes here of the hour.
I had one question, though.
Go ahead.
We should tell our listeners that, I mean, just to reiterate the idea that the real party that we should be voting for is the Green Party, because those are true socialists. Like, they're not, like, I mean, this is obvious stuff.
At least in California, New York, and perhaps
Jersey.
In Jersey, where you live. because in Ohio and Minnesota, like in Minneapolis, there was the case of, and this is very saddening to me, that you had Socialist Alternative with their strong left-wing candidate, and then there was a Green in the race who was still in the race, and they were explicitly not socialist and explicitly anti-socialist. So they were like...
That's interesting.
Yeah, these are the older Greens that are like, they're activists and community-minded and left of center, but they're not left. Which is kind of, you know, the Green Party is in its own right. We were able to be national and have ballot status in many states because there's also a Big Ten character that will have many different left of center type of characters and groups. So it's not a fully socialist party, even though, I mean, it basically, as far as the young side, people under age 40 are. And, you know, we passed our plank stating that we want a post-capitalist economy, stating that we're not a capitalist party. And there were a few delegates and such who identify as capitalists who were basically made to feel very uncomfortable about that. and we all just kind of laughed about it. So I just want to finish up with the other half of this article is a dressing down of the DSA, of whether or not like they need to, they're on like they're almost fence sitters. Like, is it okay to vote for a candidate that isn't a Democrat? Some DSA chapters, like the one in my area, have chosen to just not endorse candidates. So they just kind of avoid the question, which is not helpful because half of their membership here locally are Greens. But yet they don't lend support and work with the Green Party chapter here. So let's see, running out of time here, but he mentions the congressional candidate in L.A., which, by the way, and he also mentions a bunch of news outlets in L.A. who are progressive that haven't covered his race. And he's running against the Dem, but the DSA hasn't endorsed him. In fact, they don't even talk to him. Now, something has changed in that the Jimmy Dore show has mentioned him, but only by proxy of having Jill Stein on, and then Jill talks about him. And hasn't had him on directly, which is still kind of irksome. His name is Rodifo. When his campaign learned of the planned event, DSA event. So DSA Los Angeles sponsored in a Cortez fundraiser in August. The event was billed as a conversation with AOC about running a people power campaign and taking on the political establishment and how to mobilize communities across LA to pursuit of a better socialist future. When Rodolfo's campaign learned of this planned event, an email was sent to the DSA's LA steering committee, pointing out the cognitive dissonance, suggesting Rodolfo be part of the discussion. DSA LA responded 11 days later after the event, writing that he should be getting a candidate questionnaire in the next few weeks. Yes, the next few weeks. Where is the imperative? A DSA LA's Electoral Politics Committee platform reads, "We want to work with the voters of LA in solidarity with the city's most disenfranchised communities to put people power at every level of government to work for a socialist future." Really? Well, here's the thing. I've always supported candidates who run as Democrats if they present a real alternative to their opponents. And when a Green is not running, I have no party affiliation. But when Sanders ran in the primary in California, I requested what's called a crossover ballot, etc., etc. He mentioned Seth Ackerman of Jacobin, who has written nebulously, / theoretically, of an organization that isn't quite a socialist party, but that has some aspects of a party, a.k.a. the DSA. An organization that can run its own socialist candidates, as well as lend support to others who are at least very progressive. The writer asks, can folks not be so cryptic and just tell us if it's okay for this hypothetical organization to support candidates that are not in the Democratic Party and not, quote-unquote, independents, namely candidates running Green or another party line? I hope you're getting kind of the gist of this, that there are groups like the DSA that I'm kind of annoyed with because, let's say, here in New York, they endorsed Nixon, the primary challenger of Cuomo, but they will not endorse Hawkins. To my knowledge, they did not even have a vote to see if they would endorse him. Maybe it was up for discussion, and there are many members of the DSA in New York that would want to, but there's something about the leadership or their bylaws or something that is keeping them policy-wise as, like, our strategy is to raise up socialism by electing quote-unquote socialists who then say, we just need the New Deal again. Okay? Not good enough. So, moving on.
I mean, I think we should just
yeah.
I mean, talk about to? I mean,
yeah.
The election is on Tuesday. I mean,
yeah, sure, we can just talk about that.
If I can just plug the candidates, I'm from New Jersey and for US Congress, District 7, and Kate Dale for governor. But I think something that we should address, and I think it's really important. I mean, I've been talking to a lot of you know, workers around Newark, that's where I'm from.
Yeah.
And I tell them to vote. I mean, I suggest that they vote for Green, you know, the Green Party, and they're using that same rhetoric as in 2016. Like, you can't, like, they're saying
we can't afford to not vote.
Yes, yes, and that's deep. It's very deep in this society right now.
I wonder when would be the conditions. So it's a bad tactic, but there's the pointing out of the hypocrisy of, like, when would be the time? Like, when do we have the luxury to vote for progressive candidates? Because that time never exists, ever. It didn't exist when in the aughts. It didn't exist during the – I mean, maybe it existed a little bit in the Obama years, because we pointed out, like, we here in New York, the Green Party, got our ballot line by, you know, more people voted for our candidates – during the Obama years. Like, and so the real test is whether there's enough inertia that we will retain our ballot line this year with our gubernatorial candidate Howie Hawkins. And so that'll be the real test. The Libertarians will most likely get up their ballot line in New York because they had a candidate who was on the Joe Rogan show. And Joe Rogan will never have actual leftists on his show. I wish he did, because when he talks about socialism and has an opinion on it, he's amazingly uninformed. Not his fault in particular, but he doesn't have anyone on to talk with him about it, and that's infuriating. But anyway, so he has a boost, and he has a lot of fanboys. Larry Sharp is the Libertarian candidate. And where was I going with this? Just that...
When is there room for...
So that's... I just don't even go there, because obviously that's just arguing with the person that you're trying to outreach to. So I usually go with, it doesn't matter if Dems are in office. I mean, if you think electing a blue Congress is going to resist Trump, you're very sadly mistaken. They will not resist Trump. They will, and are in fact, even now, or during the last year, they have made announcements and held press conferences about all the things they will want to work with Trump on. Because it's two ruling parties and they have the same agenda. It's just a matter of the Dems talking nicer. And maybe, you know, the camps won't be as many and they won't send troops to the border and stuff. But they'll increase law enforcement, though. You think they won't do that? No, it will just be under a different name, a different auspice, maybe a different department will be doing it. But the result is the same. Need I remind you, the caravan is coming up from Honduras because their government was overthrown by ours, by the Clinton-run State Department, right? And that isn't so much a Hillary Clinton policy as much as it's a U.S. government policy. That if you have a left-of-center politician who was elected president in Honduras, and he was talking about redistributing land to help the peasants there, and that couldn't happen, so the State Department overthrew him. They helped the right-wing military do a coup, and it's basically created a mob state there, and that's why thousands of people have had to leave. They've been forced out of their home, driven out by force, by violence. And so that's why they're on their way here. And so we make these crises. They're not even like climate change related crises. They're man-made, you know, and it's U.S. government made. And so that's the other article that I didn't get to here was like, why would someone, this is someone in Chicago who's going to vote for the Green against the Democrat who's running against a Republican. And it's like, well, basically, if we're really going to have real change, the kind of change that fights Trump and everything he stands for and everything bad that you think is happening, we need outsiders who are real outsiders. And half of the Democrats running for Congress are CIA and security state people. And their left of center podcast, one's called The Professional Left, and they'll talk about these people like they're, oh, yeah, they're so qualified. Like, you know, CIA and, you know, people, that's who you want running the show? That's who's going to resist Trump and they're not anti-war. And that drives me around the bed. And so Any more thoughts responding to that, Josh? So, So your query was about like talking people out. So, I usually go with the it doesn't make a difference if the Dems are reelected. Real change requires real power on our end. And at the moment, if you're voting for harm reduction, you're not voting from a place of power. You're voting from a place of helplessness. And you get out of that by doing something differently. So exactly. With that tone, I'm going to jump to Steve Greenfield, congressional candidate for Congress. That's redundant. Candidate for Congress in New York 19, which is the Hudson River area. And he has a listen liberal type of rant here, and he calls himself the commie ranter. Though I don't really consider him a communist. He jokes about himself in that way. But he's still a really cool guy. Firefighter, been on a school board, and so on. So I'm going to start with that. Facebook rant of the week. Hey, liberals, we have to talk, like right this second, because of yesterday's massacre, referring to the synagogue shooting. A lot of you are posting that Martin Nealmeyer quote. You know the one. It ends with, quote, and then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. Of course you know how it ends, and you know the middle part about the Jews, and that's why you're posting it. But you're copying the entire quote, even though the first line of it is this. First they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out, because I was not a socialist. Can you see the problem here? No, you can't, so I'll explain it to you. You are the people coming for the socialists. Most of you have posted on social media about or sent messages to actual socialists here in increasingly fascist America, blaming not just socialists, but any liberal to the left of Hillary Clinton and Al Gore, both of whom are to the right of Richard Nixon, for being responsible for Bush and Trump, for being willfully complicit in the rise of fascism and bigotry. You've done it. You've watched most of your friends do it, and you've let it go without comment. You've named names, like mine, every day if you live in New York's 19th CD. You've clicked the like when your friends have named names, when some of us mention that right-wingers don't give us half the grief we get from you. You tell us that's because you're helping them. Now, he's referring to the fact that there are many liberals. He's getting hate mail from liberals as a Green because he's running in a contested congressional race. And he's hurting, and he's going to be a spoiler for the Democratic candidate, who, by the way, is a corporate lawyer, okay, who represents trust union busting. You're right, so he's getting all this liberal hate mail, and so he's kind of taking that on right now. So if you're going to post that Nealmeyer quote, to show everyone how you're aware that autocracy develops in stages and how you care about Jews and, by extension, all oppressed minorities, the new commie rancher rule, referring to himself, is that you must write it like this. First, we came for the socialists, and I thought that was great and did my share to help with that. And when the socialists objected, I accused them of working for Russia to undermine American democracy. I mean, F them with their peace, poverty, and healthcare purism. They're effing narcissistic, racist, sexist, LGBT phobic assholes. Then they came for the, you know what, F it. They can have the trade unionists, the Jews, anyone they want. I don't care about anything if I have to give a damn about socialists. The 21st century U.S. Democratic Party is the most McCarthyist institution since, well, Joe McCarthy. Sorry for swearing there. That was his voice.
I'm shook after
so
that.
Much I can censor that. So, thoughts, Josh, on that?
I think I was, I'm shook. That's some deep stuff right there. That's some woke stuff. But no, it's like... I hope there are some Democrats listening to this podcast, but this show. But
most likely are.
I kept seeing that poem being posted. I mean, directly after the Trump election, months following recently, and it's always by liberals. And it's crazy to think, like, you know, when you're pointing a finger. There's always three pointing at yourself. So it's
Well, it's in the context that in the response to the right-wing punctuated violence, I'll call it, you know, mass shooting and the sending of the pipe bombs, which none of them actually worked. It was totally, like, ineffectual. But anyway, the response from the Democratic leadership is both sides' rhetoric, right? It's that Chuck Schumer, he tweeted both sides' rhetoric. And we're hearing a bit of this from liberals, that like the right and the far left are both dangers to democracy. That they're, like, that the left is helping the right by standing on our own principles and fighting for what we want and fighting for what we believe in. Because many in the center do not believe in the same things, and they will, you know, proudly say that, and that's fine. They can have principles too. But their principles is to protect the status quo, because they're usually professionals. They're usually the people that don't want to be in the same union with the garment workers, you know, or any other retail. And I see this in my own workplace between people who are on the cusp of being managers or their department heads and their standard employee. And the different class between full-time and part-time workers. And then there's precarious workers who just get crapped on in all ways. And then when they say, I have trouble voting, I have trouble mailing something, they just get ire. And they get, like, you know, an eye roll. And instead of being actually listened to, which is just classes. You got some background noise, Josh. So we're on the last few minutes, Josh. Do you have any parting thoughts?
I don't know. I mean, that little "hey, listen, liberal" thing really has me thinking right now. But
sure, and maybe it will to you too, audience. So I'll just end that.
Make sure you vote green on Tuesday.
Vote green if there is such a candidate. And if not, write in someone you actually trust.
Vote in me, Joshua Mono.
I'm not against all defensive voting, depending on what the race is. But it shouldn't be your first justification for why you vote. You should always vote for what you actually want. As Jill Stein put it, you might just get it. But also, just don't think of voting in any political or anything as just being an individual act. You know, do it in a group. Vote with a group of people. You know, that can certainly make it seem much more exciting and less anticlimactic, which is what one college student said in an article that I won't share, but it was basically like, we asked these 10 young people why they're not voting, and the reasons varied, but it was mostly disillusionment and sometimes actual barriers. And one said, like, it's really anticlimactic. Like, oh, is that it? That's the pinnacle of the democratic process. As they say, it only takes a few minutes to vote. Why does it only? That kind of shows how ineffectual it really is as a tool for expressing your will. It should take longer. So do something that takes longer, and that means organizing, doing community project, and so on. So with this last minute, I'll do the last bit of housekeeping. This has been the Three Left Show. We are a podcast online via iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. A full edited version of this show will be there, which will be cleaner and won't have that gap that I think exists now on live. So and then there's also social media, Facebook, Twitter. Please share these things. Support the show in the ways you probably should know by now. Leave reviews on iTunes. Well, we have a Patreon page. You can donate/support myself and Josh. I think anything goes to Josh, because he certainly needs it more than I do. And that will make us have the security to work on this show more and do more research and maybe act like journalists even, but particularly be more prepared. So thank you very much for joining me. It is noon now. Thank you very much. This has been the Three Left Show. Solidarity to all.
Solidarity forever.
Yep. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Open the gates and seize the day. Don't be afraid and don't delay. Nothing can break us. No one can make us give our rights away. Arise and seize the day.
Now is the time to seize the day.
Now is the time to seize the day.
Send out the call and join the fray.
Send out the call and join the fray.
Wrongs will be righted. If we're united,
let us seize the day.
Friends of the friendless, seize the day.
Friends of the friendless, seize the day.
Raise up the torch and light the way.
Raise up the torch and light the way. Proud and defiant, we'll slay the giant. Let us seize the day.
Don't delay.